Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 25 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask a writer to root around our archive and pick out a story to read and discuss with me here. On this month's episode, I'm joined by Colin Bard, who has chosen to read The Untamable Donkey by David McGrath, published in issue 47, volume 2 of The Stinging Fly, which he'll be reading for us today. Colin Bard is from County Mayo, Ireland. In 2009, he was awarded the Penguin Ireland Prize, and in 2014, his debut collection of stories, Young Skins, was published by the Stinging Fly Press, and it was awarded the Rooney Prize, the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Prize, and the Guardian First Book Award. In 2018, he was announced as the Rolex Arts Initiative Literary Protégé, mentored by Colm Tobin. His stories have appeared in the Stinging Fly magazine, The New Statesman, The New Yorker, Harper's, and read on Radio 4. And Calm with Horses was adapted for a feature film starring Barry Keoghan, Cosmo Jarvis, and Niamh Alger, released in 2020. Colin's debut novel, Wild Houses, is due to be released in early 2024. Hi, Colin.
Hello.
So, would you mind reading a little bit from the story you've chose, The Untamable Donkey, for us?
Sure. So, I won't read the whole thing because it's a little longer than is feasible, but I'll read like the first half of this great story. The crack was near becoming the worst sheep farmer in Ballybald. His sheep approached the tractor, doing their best to trust again after the Christmas shortage. "I'd stand well back, sheep," the crack told them. "This might be ugly." The crack beat the horn on the tractor to get them scrammed, but it was broken. Everything was always broken. "Go on now, sheep, get." The withered old sheep backed off but encroached again when the crack wasn't looking. "I don't know what's going to happen when I open the tailgate." The sheep didn't understand and told him as much. "Suit yourself, so." The crack backed the horse box into the paddock. When he jumped down into the muck, he kicked out his way bits of pallet and split bucket. He looked inside the horse box to see how the untamable donkey had travelled. She was in there calm as bottled water. "You just look like you need a good wash," she stomped. "You don't like authority," the crack said as he unlocked the tailgate. "That's all, like myself. Willie, come out here, Willie." Full of welcome, little Willie trotted over towards the horse box. He was such a grand and lovely little donkey. The crack hoped the untamable donkey would see the manners on little Willie and take emulation. "I need this donkey tamed, Willie," the crack said as he unhooked the latches on the horse box, "or we're in trouble. So show her the ropes. Promote grace and good manners." But no sooner had the crack dropped the tailgate did the untamable donkey shoot from the horse box like a natural disaster. The crack realised she'd been biding her time in there, not calm at all, now unleashing, charging hard for little Willie, who didn't know what was about to hit him. She chomped down his ear. "The poor little crater," the crack shouted, and made to find something to hit her with. But little Willie hadn't the time to wait for rescue. Before he lost it, he pulled his ear out from between her broken teeth and brayed away back from whence he came for cover. The untamable donkey turned around and eyeballed the crack's sheep, who were no dipsticks and knew trouble when they saw it. They hightailed it for the hills. The untamable donkey tore after them, never minding gates and their usage, ripping through the paddock fence instead. She galloped across the hillside in assault of the sheep, kicking and tripping them, snapping the backs of those that fell, and when they were down, she mercilessly stamped their heads into the muck. "My poor old sheep," the crack cried, and when enough sheep were dead, the untamable donkey turned her sights to mankind. She fired back for the crack, with brain-soaked fence posts flapping from her hinds. The crack ran up into the horse box for cover. "A donkey that'll kill us all," he said, "and off beyond. A poor old sheep, bad, its last bad, to confirm it." The untamable donkey stamped up the tailbox into the horse box. The crack backed into a far corner and hunkered down in it. She approached slow. He saw that the dirt in her coat was dried blood. They'd been whipping her something terrible. Ulcers clawed under her teeth, and she drooled slime and filth onto the toe of his boots. She was rain-scalded, melanders on her forelegs, maggots in her ears, mange in her mane, and a blood-sodden hatred in every fibre of her being for mankind and its blood sports. She reared up on him, showing him the hooves he was to be trampled with, to melt him before death in fear and sheep-slaughtered stink. But the crack was not going out death by donkey, because the crack was last of the old-school alcoholics. The crack may have been near becoming the worst sheep farmer in Ballybald, but he was Phelan's best customer, with a weekly consumption of alcohol that read more like an inquest. Graveyards of men had their photographs nailed to the wall in Phelan's after reckoning their whole lives that if the crack was alive, despite the drink he packed away and the calamity he endured, they would be grand, realising only in their dying moments with nothing but stories of cirrhosis and misadventure to conclude them that the crack was a miracle of human biology and impossible to kill by circumstance. And so, without knowing that the stars above them shone in the crack's favour, the untamable donkey stomped down for the kill, only to miss the crack's head by a dripple. A slat of the horse box had come loose from all of her kicking. It was enough to squeeze through. The crack landed badly in the muck outside, but he was alive to go on outliving all men and donkeys. The crack ran back around to lock her back in, then leaned on the horse box for support. He took from his coat a flask of whiskey and drank back a slug, and another, then another. There are six traits a species requires for domestication, the crack said when the world had settled. And I'm not talking about taming. One can tame any animal out there. But to take a species out of the wild and into the field, it must have several characteristics. The species must reach maturity fairly lively. Men can't be dawdling for decades, paying for copybooks and gap years, so some sheep can find inner meaning on a beach, then go exploring its sexuality, all to get only a few chops and a woolly jumper out of it. The species must breed in captivity. I know one particular ram, and I'm not conning you. Donkey, he'd find a tup if you strapped a straitjacket on him and fired him 40 miles out to sea. And the species can't be a picky eater. One can't be scaling Icelandic cliff faces for a specific type of lotus every time a sheep wants breakfast. The crack slugged back more whiskey. The species has to be part of a social hierarchy that man can place himself at the head of. Sheep are a flock animal, gregarious, with a dominance hierarchy. It means they have a natural inclination to follow a leader to greener pastures, and I, their shepherd, shall be their trailblazer all day long, donkey. The crack knocked on the horse box. You listening in there? This applies to you. We need to get you tamed or all fucked. The untamable donkey roared and screamed. The species can't be nervy, the crack told her. I know sheep jolt. But not like when I tried to raise deer that time. Little Willie moseying on over to take a look at the deer and the deer take off. And Little Willie gives chase because he thinks it's a game. Next minute, Little Willie is droving the whole herd into oncoming cars on the Carrickbeg Road at 30 miles an hour. A fucking disaster. The crack emptied the flask into himself. And finally, the species must have a pleasant disposition. I know some sheep can be cantankerous, but they're not skulking around in the dead of night, ripping the throats out of sleeping children or stamping other sheep's heads into the muck and cracking their skulls. The untamable donkey turned in the horse box to kick out an effort to take the crack's head clean off. I need solitary confinement for you, the crack said, and returned to town with the untamable donkey smashing his horse box to pieces in his rear-view mirror. No, Tom Phelan said in feelings. Little Willie's allowed in. Little Willie has manners on him. He sits and does harm to nobody. I'm not asking that she come in here. I'll keep her out in the barrel yard. No. The barrel yard was once the livestock yard. On mart days. When was the last mart day in Ballybalt? I'll pay your rent on it. Tom Phelan had a famously big turnip head in him, with which he pretended to think about it. What if she does any damage? I'll financially amend damage if there's damage. And that was that. The crack reversed around the back of Phelan's. He opened the tailgate to release the untamable donkey into the pub's barrel yard. She kicked around in rage, cracking the yard brush and making shite of the old bar stools. And when everything was good and broken, she upended the empty beer barrels. Their dregs gushed out of their valves and drenched her in stale stout. And onwards she smashed, thrashing at the steel gate that had her imprisoned. The whole of Phelan's came out to marvel at the hatred in her black ball stare. Hatred that began as far back as her African wild-ass ancestors who were hunted by the Egyptians, speared and roped and roasted whole. Hatred that spiralled when the Sumerians made the wheel and stole her from the scrublands to pull it, to haul their stone to the fertile crescent of Mesopotamia for the first cities. And she hauled their ore to the smelters in Damascus, the rock out of Nubian gold mines. And on the Trebizond and Trebon trade route she was 45,000 strong, a caravan of work, thrashed and whipped onwards to expand empires, powering the water pumps and the grain mills, ploughing earth for the vine, then carrying the wine to market. And when the dying civilizations needed scape donkeys, she was there, thrown over cliffs as retribution for the death of Osiris. And when the dying towns needed a symbol to bear the weight of their sins and failure of their crop, she was there to burn alive. She carried their prophets and their Christs, and she was whipped into war, pulling in supply carts only to pull out the wounded, dying en masse in French mud, blown to pieces on the beaches of Gallipoli, freezing to death while carrying screw guns and cannons across alpine mountain passes. And they saw her parachuted into the Burmese jungle and strapped with bombs in Kandahar, watching her children castrated and starved as she was thrashed to the grave, or called vermin and shot from helicopters in Australia, or massacred by the tens of thousands in South Africa, where she was shot in pens to her back and head and legs to die screaming or hacked alive for pet meat. Jilted and ghosted, the odd-toed ungulate, the idiot. She became the joke, the indolent and stubborn fool, reborn again and again the cruel wagon masters who beat her with rods, and she forgave and forgave, but ne'er forgot, carrying men on their shoulders, being whatever was needed for their stories, resurrected time and time again, the sign of good or the sign of evil, the god or the fool, the king or the peasant, the right or the wrong, until she had the blood-mad dog set in her, a Rottweiler hanging from her throat at the bottom of a pit, 50 bearding men cheering on her death, and enough was enough.
Thank you. That was great. Can you tell me how you found the story and why you chose the story?
Well, I read it. It was in the sort of the Sting and Fly short story award this year. It was one of the ones that was selected.
Oh, okay.
And there was a bunch of very strong stories in there. Many of them are in this issue as well, I think. And I read it then. And it just really struck me. It was very different. It was very, you know, a lot of the stories are very strong, but this one was very, it stayed with me after I read it. It had a certain energy to it that I really liked.
Yeah, no, it is. It's really energetic, and the language is really energetic in some ways. It reminded me of your own work a little bit, because it seems on the surface, you know, a rather straightforward story about a donkey initially, and then it does that very odd thing where it goes into the history of the donkey,
yeah.
Which makes it sort of like a little, all of it like just a little odder. And I really enjoyed that. It's what really elevated it for me. Are you always kind of looking for those moments in the stories you read?
Yeah, I'm always looking for an energy, and it doesn't have to be. Now, this, you know, it is a very madcap story. Mm-hmm. To me, it's like a Looney Tunes cartoon, you know. Mm. It's like the Roadrunner versus Wile E. Coyote. Mm-hmm. It's the crack versus the untamable donkey. I mean, that's basically just what it is, these two beings facing off. You know, so it has that quality to it, this madcap, you know, cartoonish quality. Mm. I mean, that as a compliment. It has a real... It just has this premise, and mm-hmm. it just attacks it, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's not, you know, that's not how energy has to manifest in stories. I think when I say that, people sometimes misinterpret that as it has to be full of anarchy and like event. It's not that at all. It's that it really just, yeah, it sketches out this very elementally simple mm-hmm. premise mm-hmm. and just goes with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And doesn't flinch from it, and doesn't play it for, like, it's funny because, I mean, it leans into a bunch of obvious mm-hmm. tropes about alcoholic farmers and, like, you know, yeah, insanely yeah. violent.
The descriptions of drinking are really good in it.
Yeah.
And the hangovers are also very good.
Yes. And it leans right into it, you know.
Yeah.
But just, it never flinches. It doesn't, it doesn't worry about mm-hmm. that, which I think is a very good thing to keep in mind when you're trying to write anything, because you can mm-hmm. become paralyzed by fearing if you're succumbing to tropes, or you know, are you doing something that's been done before or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny that you said, like, it reminds me of my work, because of course I thought, well, this is different to my work. This is so different. Like this guy writes in a completely different way to me, like the way he's approaching this. I might write about an alcoholic farmer beating up a donkey, but you know, I would approach it in a different way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's hilarious. Like that's the way it is, of course. So
yeah,
yeah.
It's just the kind of language, like some of his kind of metaphors and some of these are also like. They're just very good, like your own, you know, and how he sort of plays with language. But one thing I really, really liked about this was that, you know, it's about these characters in a sort of difficult situations and things, like the man, but they don't really, how can I phrase this? They don't really want to improve themselves. Like, they don't really want to get out of it. They don't really want to improve themselves. And that's my favorite thing about your work.
Improving.
No sense of getting better.
Like I said, you know, it's leaning into a certain type of trope, but that trope's probably outdated, about like the self-destructive alcoholic farmer,
yeah, yeah.
You know, or whatever you want to, you know, taciturn rural men who'd rather just die of, you know, heart disease than go see a doctor. I don't know if that's true anymore. I think if any farmers under 40 now, they're all drinking tea, and they are like mental health
herbal
advocates.
Tea.
They're doing
like
TEDx talks about like mental health and you know, and
that's a good story.
So you know, and that's also completely legitimate. It's certainly probably a nicer way to be about it. But yeah, it's just a story that just leans into that. I actually because I read it as part of the Sting and Fly short story competition, and I've probably judged 3 or 4 short story competitions over the last couple of years, and I did a big one in England there recently, and so I've read, like, I'd say I've read about 150 short stories this year, you know.
Wow.
Just as it so happens, yeah. It was 95 in that competition.
That's a
alone.
Lot.
Alone, it's a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
And I suppose I was just thinking, and what I, maybe the reason I picked this story was, I kind of was just, as I was reading all these stories, like, and what I like about this one is it kind of has like as I say, it has this cartoonish energy to us, this like manic, anarchic energy that's like out of a folktale or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And the short stories, it just occurred to me reading all these stories is like, and lots of stories are, I write in a realist mode. I write literary realism, I suppose, if you have to call it something. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're not quite agreeing there.
But there's a thing
called literary realism, right? And it's in a lot of like novel, you know, contemporary novels of sort that they're in the mainstream and whatnot. And but the short story is just, the more of them I was reading, the more I was like, these, they don't really, even when they're ostensibly kind of realistic, they have a mask of realism.
They're not really,
it's like saying a poem is realistic, you know, short stories aren't really, the good ones, as I said, this one does, it sort of just has its own premise. It doesn't matter what the premise is. It doesn't matter what it's about. It can be about something completely mundane, or it can be about something very, you know, very, very, very exotic or unique. It doesn't matter. But it just has a short amount of time to sort of, you just attack this premise, just commit to it and see it through. And that's what this story does. And like when it goes into this Jeremiah halfway through about all the donkeys in history and how they've been chewed up.
And it
turns it into something else.
Yeah.
But the story, and even though, as I say, the first few pages has been this sort of like dark slapstick, you know, fight between an insanely alcoholic farmer and this like, you know, feral donkey. It somehow works, you know.
It would never have occurred to me to do that.
And it's, you know, it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but I think within the story it works and it opens up this other dimension, and then it carries through into another mode towards the end of the story, because I only read half it. And, you know, it just amazes you what a story does, the kind of intensities and things it can do. And that's often not available to novels, you know. They can do their own things. I'm not saying one's better than the other for everyone out there, but you can't, it's hard to bring that sort of energy to a novel. The novel has to have a different one.
A novel can't sustain that sort of energy. If you go at it with that kind of intense, you know, and we can talk about that in a minute.
Like, of course we can. There's only novelists in the room here now, you know.
Yeah. But I think that, like if that was a novel across like 200 pages, that kind of language, that kind of energy on every single page, you'd be exhausted, you know. You couldn't. Like, I think, the novel requires something different. But when you were reading all these stories for these competitions, and 95 stories is a lot to read.
Yeah.
And I've been very bad at reading stories this year. But when you kind of picked your favorite ones, what did you feel like they had in common? Or what was it? What were you looking for? Or what moment or what elevated it for you?
Well, I suppose, something like what happens here with the history of the donkeys. Mm. It's just something unexpected within it, you know? So it sets out a premise and then it moves somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that just, it just really imparts a sense of it being alive. And that's a mystery. You can't really put your finger on that. And all art does it to a greater or lesser degree. But it surprises you in some way and opens up the world, you know, and makes it feel real, which is a silly thing to say, but it makes it feel like it's there anyway. I suppose like some stories I read, you know, that didn't make it or whatever, they just didn't quite have that, you know, and I try not to have the vocabulary even internally in my head of whether someone's a good or bad writer or a story's good or bad. They just generally need more work whatever, or need to be put down and then attacked again. That happens all the time. My own work, it's, you know, just constant, recurring, you know, abandonment and then going back to it. And, you know, so I suppose this story and the best ones, you know, what I considered the best ones and the ones I read had something of that. They had this sort of internal surprise waiting for you. Mm. You know, just the world felt, you know, and it's the skill of a writer. It felt like something. It felt like the story has its own agency inside itself. You know,
I agree, and I also feel like the stories. If it's about characters who are feeling sort of stuck, you know, in their environment or their circumstances, it should start somewhere but end up somewhere different, even if their like physical environment doesn't change and things. That's what I really enjoy, you know. That element of
not much has to happen on the surface.
Nothing has to happen, actually.
You know, like, literally nothing can happen.
It just, I think I prefer when nothing happens, actually. Even though lots happens in this.
A lot happens in this one.
Yeah, a lot happens.
You can't say a lot doesn't happen in
and
your
a lot happens in your stories. Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, so you had your first story in The Stinging Fly in when? And what story was that, Colin? I think I've read it.
Let's see, I'd say 2013, I think. Earlier, I think. No, 2009 or something.
Yeah. And how long had you been writing?
I mean, I've been writing,
I've been writing all through my adolescence, and so, you know, trying to write, I don't know what you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
Could a 16-year-old think they were writing plausibly publishable stuff?
You think
God
you
almighty,
are.
God almighty, probably. Yeah. Probably. Would you have written during your adolescence and stuff?
I did, yeah, yeah. I wrote
sometimes I meet someone that they didn't start till their 20s or something, like, you know, which I guess is fine, but I just...
Yeah, I did as well. And all the stuff was bad. You know, I wrote the short stories for, like... You know, English and stuff that I thought were brilliant, you know?
Oh, God, I think
and they were all just like Roddy Doyler.
I wrote one about an abusive priest or something. So handed it into my English teacher in school.
I did. I wrote one about an abusive marriage as well.
The amount they get, must have got back.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, fortunately. But yeah, no, I was writing on that. And, you know, so I always took it seriously when I was doing it.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, I was writing on, yeah, all through my 20s and stuff.
Yeah. And why short stories?
They were the form I came last to. Yeah. I mean, I was reading a lot of poetry and novels when I was younger. And then I just started reading, in and around college. I don't know, I just got into, UCD had a big library, and this was before there was that much stuff on the internet. So you kind of, you know, I was reading all Paris reviews and indeed the Sting and Fly. Sting and Fly was around. There was issues in UCD. It was in the literary magazine periodical section. And... that was a big discovery for me. I mean, I said this before, but just like, oh, look, there's people who are alive now writing. Yeah, yeah. I don't have to just read, you know, a Chekhov story from, you know, 120 years ago to, you know, there's people right now and there's petrol stations in it and bypasses and all that beautiful stuff that makes us who we are. You know, so that was it, really. I discovered it. It seemed, you know, I loved the form. I fell in love with the form. You can't, you know, there's no other way to do it. But it seemed feasible because there was this literary magazine culture springing up, so you can try and get, I don't know how the hell you would go around writing, like getting a novel published or something, or a book published full stop.
Yeah.
How do you get them into bookstores? How's that work?
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And it seemed like such a massive kind of undertaking that like, whereas like a story did feel, particularly when you knew that the Sting and Fly was like there and like could be contacted.
It's a magazine.
Yeah, yeah. That like, it felt like you could write a story and it would feasibly be published, but I had no idea.
There was an email address right there you could send it to.
Even so, it wasn't,
you know,
done.
In the back of the magazine. Yeah. It's like, no one would ever look at this, but of course they did. But
And you had your first story published in what year again? Sorry.
I'd say 2008, 2009, something like that, I think. Yeah.
And how do you feel about that first story now? Have you reread it or have you left it?
Oh, God, no. Yeah. No, it was called Let's Go Kill Ourselves.
That's a great title, though.
Great 20 something, although I think I was 30. Title. And it's about absolutely, like, it's just about some school kids, like, I mean, you know, anyway, it's no, I mean, it was definitely the first proper story I wrote, you know, it was different than everything else, so I can't have anything other than affection for it, because, I mean, a distant affection.
Yeah. Had you had stories previously that you hadn't published?
I don't think I finished any. I was weird. I would start stuff and not finish them.
I also used to do that
for years.
Time. Yeah, yeah.
Like, you'd always be writing. Mm. And you'd have told some of your friends or something you're writing, you'd let it slip, you know, in a moment of weakness. And they'd be like, yeah, you're always scribbling away there. And they're like, can I read something? Like, well, I haven't finished anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, we've been living together for 5 years. What do you mean you haven't finished anything?
And, it's so hard to finish a story.
It's so hard. Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe I just knew in some way something wasn't, you know, there was something wrong with each thing. But it wasn't discouragement. I just start something else. Mm. But that one just, you know, I mean, I finished it, which is, you know, you do got to finish them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that helped. And it just has, it had a bit of a different energy to it. And all that was I'd read enough stuff at that point and digested enough stuff that I was able to, you know.
I think you know when
throw out this reasonable facsimile of a decent story. Like, it's quite, you know, it's quite creaky, but sure, listen, you got to start somewhere.
Exactly. And like, I think you know when something is, well, I certainly knew, like, in between the stuff that I hadn't published and, like, hadn't finished to the, like, a few years later when I was writing stories that I was actually finishing, the sort of difference, or, like, even my interest was different. Like, I was, I had more interest. I was like, I will finish this than the stuff I was writing about previously, because I think I didn't know what I wanted to write about. Did it take you a little while to find that?
Yeah, well, I, you know, I thought you'd set stories in New York and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I thought that'd
you
be
do,
about.
You do, though.
Kind of do, don't you?
Yeah, you have to, but, eventually.
Well, no, and then you read more. And well, you know, but like, you'll read, I don't know, whatever, you know, Faulkner or somebody, or and it's in the, you know, it's in this, you know, it's in this, you know, it's not in an urban metropolis they've set their story or anything, but still, it still has a weird glamour to it because it's just somewhere else, you know. But I didn't know what I wanted to write about. The desire to write and the compulsion to write long preceded have an end to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't really, I can't really trust people who say they have some story they need to tell. You know, there's only one story they have to tell. It's like, well, all right, okay, fine. But in my case, it was the urge, the will to write was long preceded, and you just, it's an act of blind faith that you might actually have something to say, and there's nothing revelatory to it. It's just, oh, I need to write about. You know, the world, the reality I know best, which is in and around where I grew up and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of formative experiences, and just transmute them into fiction. I had no interest in doing anything autobiographical or biographical, and I still don't. I mean, don't know how anyone does it, but it's important that it has a certain type of what might be termed authenticity to it, and that I am writing about, you know, broadly speaking, a world I know, experiences that are familiar to me, but they have to be. It's very, very important that they're transmuted into fiction. It doesn't work otherwise.
Yeah. I feel like, did you, you know, when I was starting out, I was writing stuff, you know, that I had nothing to do with me or didn't. I was writing, I was writing bad Colin Barrett, really.
Oh, God. Well, I was writing bad Colin. I still write bad Colin Barrett, yeah.
I'm glad you started out writing bad Colin Barrett. But did you... Was there any moment where you felt like, now I feel like I have permission to write about, you know, these people I grew up with, this area that I know well, and I obviously, you know,
so I avoided it for a long time.
Yeah,
but I never required permission per se. There wasn't any one person I could ask.
Yeah,
which doesn't help, or does help, I guess. No, I did. I mean, you know, and I mean, you know, you're not writing literally about anyone anyway, or, you know, I wasn't, but you also do, I mean, you know, it's never fair to say, like, basically I found work, I found stories, I found other writers who were writing about their equivalent of where I'm from, or they, you know, they were writing, you know, whatever, quote unquote, regional literature, you know, and about, you know, lower working class, you know, lower middle class communities or whatever, and small towns and small town mores and small town etiquette and all that. So, you know, you find other books and writers who do that, and then you realize they're the ones who give you permission. They're the ones who give you permission.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not.
Yeah.
Not the priest or the
oh, it was my priest.
The head of the G. Actually, go down to the priest. I wrote a story about. I exposed you guys in. I got a C+ for it in. You know,
when I was 16.
When I was 16, I sent it to my English teacher, but I come now to ask you.
But I feel
so. It's other. It's stories. It is. It's other writers give permission. Then you just get giddy about it and you go do it. You know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I didn't. You know.
And from then, you know, you had that first story published, and you probably, you know, did you develop a relationship with The Stinging Fly and, you know, Declan, and you got more and more stories published until, you know, when was it decided that you published Young Skins?
I sent in one story and it got taken, and then I sent two more and I heard nothing. And so then I emailed Declan and go, Declan wants to have those stories. And he's like, you know, they're not quite right. And but then I just sent... I did send another one, and then I don't know, I sent a few. And this is over like 2 or 3 years, you know, it's over quite a relaxed time scale, which I found very useful. I mean, again, I don't, you know, I can totally understand that people want to be in a rush at these things or whatever, but I was very happy to sort of just float along, send in one story every 6 months to see if the Sting of Fly would take it or whoever. And I mean, eventually we'd 3 or 4, but Declan sat down with me and kind of said it early enough on. He said, if you're interested, I want to know, are you going to write a short story collection? And don't do it just for me, do it because you want to. And then we'll take a look at it. So he was, you know, it was a quite relaxed, but definite, like, structure there, you know. That's all I needed. I didn't need to go signing contracts right then and there or doing anything like that at all. I just took, and that was, you know, that was a couple of years at least before we actually did publish the book. So it was quite... I really, really appreciate that. I really, really like that, you know, that Declan and the Sting of Fly and the whole apparatus was just I could periodically go to them and, you know, I'd send them something and, you know, there'd be a reading on or whatever, and I'd go to that. And I just, just totally became a fly head.
Is that what we're calling ourselves? I think that you know, Young Skins has become the sort of seminal book. And it's actually the only book I think I've read in one sitting. You know the way that people say that, I read it in one sitting. Yours is probably the only one I've read in one sitting. But how did it feel then to work on your second collection, Homesickness, which came out last year? Was it last year?
It was 2022. Oh, was that last year?
No, this is 2023, yeah.
I thought it came out three months ago.
No.
I think it was like 18 months ago or something, yeah.
Time is very strange.
It's 2022, yeah.
Yeah.
Came out, yeah.
So what did you feel like, obviously in that time period you were living in Canada and things, but what were the differences? Did you feel in writing a second collection of stories? Did you feel like more experienced, like you knew your way around it better? Because I never do. No. I feel like every time I sit down to write anything, I'm totally from scratch, you know?
Well, very bracingly, I had just ongoing failure to write a novel I was trying to write. So, you know, every day I was acquainted with the failure of writing this novel.
Yeah.
And so the stories, I was doing them in tandem. I mean, when I was writing Young Skins, I would write two or three stories at a time anyway. So I always like working on more than one thing at any one time. That's how I always worked. So while I was trying to write this novel, I was writing those stories every now and then. And again, I just had this, you know, it's how they always work. They just sort of, something suggests it to you, something very obscure and nebulous often quite early on, but you kind of, there's something there and you know it's a story, or you think it's a story rather than a component of the novel or anything like that. And it wasn't too dissimilar. I mean, I suppose it was good as I had this major project, which was this novel, which was just, I was just, you know, just, it was just killing me at how bad I was at it. and so I could kind of, I didn't have any neuroses left over for worrying about a second story collection or how it would go. Yeah. You just got to put the neuroses somewhere else.
With one place.
And the anxiety somewhere else. Yeah. So I kind of would just periodically do a story and, you know, and it was the same. I didn't worry about like, because Young Skins had like the conceit of it was all set in the same town, you know, which really helped at the time writing those stories. I didn't quite need anything like that in Homesickness, although I just used real names, real regions, and real towns and real names, which maybe that was the conceit or the mechanism I needed for those stories. But they just kind of came along. They came along. I mean, you know, I love writing short stories, and you know, if you had told me I had to sit down and write three in a row, I'd become very demoralized. You know, I like just doing one. Sounds whatever it sounds, and don't say, I just do want to take my fancy. I'm always working on them. There's always a few there that I'm working on, but time is what you need for short stories.
And did you feel that moving to, you know, this time period, not in, I'm sure people have asked you this a lot, but not in Ireland, not in Mayo, working on stories, did you feel like it changed your writing in any way?
No.
Yeah.
Not really. I don't know. I don't think so.
Maybe the stuff that you were going to write about, like, is already decided by...
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. By your 16, you know, when you're...
Oh, jeepers.
Yeah. Because you didn't set many stories. I think there's one set in Canada.
It does take a while, though. I mean, I was 6 years in Canada, which sounds like a long time, but it's not really when you...
Yeah.
Deduct two for the pandemic. To get to know a place or to get, you know, to think that to allow something to filter in that's useful, that can turn into something. So maybe I will write about Canada in like 5 years or something, you know, more in a more concentrated way, but maybe not. I don't know. Being out of Ireland that long and the pandemic, you know, really made it surreal. I did feel a disconnect from Ireland, you know. So it's really nice to be back and a bit surreal.
And you to
it's the same but it's different.
Yeah.
It's the same but it's different.
Everyone's older.
Gold, profound. Gold coming out of me now.
That's what the podcast does. Yeah, so,
which is just, you know, it's just a component of getting older and stuff. Yeah. That's a new thing. That's a new energy that comes into your writing anyway, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I felt when I was younger I was writing towards something and now I feel like I'm writing back towards, like I'm writing backwards.
Yeah.
In terms of I'm trying to catch something before it disappears.
Very nice.
Or incredibly bleak, I don't know. Yeah.
I do feel that. And I wonder, you know, when you're older and you maybe possibly read Young Skins again, like how will you feel about that? Because even my earlier work, I'm like, that's a very specific point of time. And, you know, I'm like, I wouldn't do that now. And I wonder, will you feel the same way?
Well, you read any book you write, you're going to be like, well, I couldn't write that one again.
Wouldn't be
the same, would it?
Yeah.
No. Which is good, I think. Probably be in trouble if you're like
Exactly.
Looking at the book 10 years later, like, I could write that. In fact, I'm going to write the exact same book again. You know,
I feel like the same person.
I haven't changed at all. Damn.
Reading that story you wrote when you were 16, being like, it's good, actually.
I had it all figured out then. Yeah.
But I was saying a little bit earlier that something I really love about your work, and I've always loved about your work, is I think in publishing we sort of love talk about working class people and things like that, but only when they're trying to get out of their environment and, you know, do something different and, you know, like improve themselves. I don't think that always works, and I really enjoy reading your characters because I think their environment, they're fully in it, you know, and there's no desire to move or anything, but moving would be so huge and you know. What attracts you to writing these kind of...
That's just how I like to write.
Yeah.
And I think whatever the subject matter would be, it would be about just trying to bring immediacy to the story and trying to just have be present with the characters in the story, you know. You can have great... I'm bad at planning, so I turn that into a good thing in my mind by being like, what I'm after in stories is immediacy. I think that's what I talk about when I talk about energy or whatever. It's a very vague concept, but it's sort of an immediacy and bringing the character, just having the characters all on the same level as you and as the reader. And that's how they're going to best, that's how the reader's going to be, that's how they're going to come most alive to the reader. Holding them at arm's length is no good. And so you have to go down and see the world from those characters. Point of view and their perspective and their logic and their, you know, they're of course capable, like anyone, of looking or being pensive and taking a look at themselves. But that's not how it is day to day for most of us, is it? It's not how your life is.
So most
of it is a day to day churn, a day to day whirl. And that's what I try and, I mean, I love trying to capture that, right? I love trying to just, you know, even if it's just someone getting up and getting in the car and going to work, I love trying to make that alive in stories. It's in art, it's really, really beautiful, and you can't overestimate, like, interiority is overrated in writing.
I think so.
You know, you can't have too much. You're talking about the sort of work, like aspirant arc in work is what's preferred in working class or indeed marginal stories from marginalized communities, marginal people, but also that sort of like looking back from a position of improvement.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking back wistfully. Yeah. And, you know.
And I got out, but they're all stuck there.
There's a lot that's implied. Yeah. And, you know, it's often kind of just, you know, I don't know, that's not what I'm trying to do. It's an aesthetic thing. It's an aesthetic choice as much as anything. I just want to be there and present with the characters.
Yeah.
And show you their life. Mm. Try and show you their life from as they're experiencing it in the moment. I mean, I went through a phase when I was writing the homesickness stories of like wanting to completely excise backstory, like not giving any context.
I was going to ask about this. There is that great story in homesickness about about the writer, and everything's just sort of forwards.
Those other ones I did it with as well, and like editors would like sit me down and go, listen, now you have to give a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
There's The Ways, which has the protagonist, Pell is the main character, and she's her older brother and her younger brother, and they're orphans, their parents died. And the first draft, I just didn't put in that their parents were dead. I didn't put it in. Like, I just, the whole story proceeds as it proceeds, which she's like the de facto, she's out of school and she's looking after the younger fella, and she goes into, he's had a fight in school, and she goes in to sort it out, and she rings her elder brother, and they're like the parents. But I just never put in, again, adhering to my half-cocked idea that it's just the present moment, and she just, you know, these characters are trying to not think about their dead parents. They're trying to just get on with life.
Yeah.
And therefore, unless it would not naturally come up, and it just happened not to in the course of the events of the first draft, I'm going to leave it out. But the problem then is, as people who read it were like, listen, the problem then is the lack of context becomes a mystery.
Yeah.
And then it's almost, it's taken away from the immediacy, from the immediate flow of events that you're trying to, you know, capture, because any reader would be like, where the fuck are these people's, these teenage characters' parents, what's happening here? Yeah. And they will believe that that's a mystery that's going to be solved at the end. And if it's not, they'll feel cheated. And it will also, as I say, distract from the immediate flow. So you need a little bit of, you know, you can't get away with no backstory, but I do try and keep it as minimal as possible and see if you can do everything, if you can present everything in the present moment, the here and now.
I do feel like the value of that. And I feel also the way you write action and things, it just feels very truthful to me. You know, you have these, you go about your day and you're doing all these things and you might have like a glimmer of self-knowledge, but you might not either, you know?
Like I might not.
Just and, a second of it.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of an effect you're after in your work a lot, too, Nicole. And like, I used to always think, of course, well, I'm going to have to say something profound sooner or later in here. Either me as the author or I'm going to have to put it in the mouth of one of my characters. They're going to have to say, they're going to have to eloquently sum up the themes that I'm exploring in this story or novel. And then I realize that's not how it works, and it's not, like, you listen to people talk and any old shite comes out of their mouth. But it does contain all the truth.
Yeah.
And it does contain the profundity of their life, even when it's lies, even when it's cliches, even when it's just like just phatic speech, just noise for the sake of it. And it contains it all. And that's what I know I'm chasing in my writing. I'm just trying to capture that sort of like, people give it, everything's on everyone's face, who they are and what's, it's all there and legible. And you can understand it in some way, but it doesn't mean they can articulate it to you, and it doesn't mean you can articulate it back to them. Which is the tragedy of what we call being.
Wow. Oh, my.
I've had a big coffee.
Okay, so now the tragedy of the novel. So can we talk about this?
Yeah.
How did you find that? I've read it. It's fantastic.
Oh, jeez. It was a slog.
Yeah. It always is.
Which they all are, yeah.
Yeah. What did you feel had changed from the stories to the novel?
Well, it's what we said earlier. You can't, and I was aware of this. I knew this going in intellectually. I knew you can't, the energy that you can find, in the intensity you can find in a story, it won't work over a novel generally. Yeah. You know, generally it's hard to do, or you need to find another way to do it. So I knew that going in, and probably that, I don't know, maybe that inhibited me too much. I was overthinking it or something, you know? Because you think you can solve all these problems in advance and you can't. You just have to write a draft.
And it's going to
have all the problems that you knew it would have.
And then you
go back and clock them over the head and sort them out. Yeah. So it was just, the plot of the story never really changed, you know, I mean, insofar as I had the conception of it, but I did a, you know, a big rewrite on the first draft. So, you know, I probably did write a second novel just with the same plot.
Yeah.
And a handful of the same characters, but...
Can you tell us a little bit about what it's about?
It's kind of about a kidnapping, really. Mm. That's basically the top line event. But it's not really... It kind of is a kidnapping. Is it a kidnapping?
I would class it as a kidnapping. If it happened to me, I would
in the eyes
like,
of
that
the
was
law.
A kidnapping.
Yeah. So there's two parties, and one party owes another party money. And so two lads grab a teenage boy who's the younger brother of a lad who owes money to someone, basically. Mm-hmm. And they bring him to a house. This is all happening in the west of Ireland, small town west of Ireland. Mm. And they bring him a house of a reclusive young guy. Everyone's kind of in their, you know, in their 20s. Mm. Named Dev, who just lives alone. He lived alone with his mother, and his mother died. And he was someone who dropped out of school and worked for a while. And then after his mother died, sort of just became massively depressed and just withdrew. And he lives out in the middle of nowhere. And these lads bring this fella they've kidnapped, this teenage boy they've grabbed, to Dev's house. And so the whole novel just takes place over two or three days. Mm. And Dahl is the lad who's been kidnapped, and his girlfriend Nikki is the other main character in the novel, and she's we follow her. She kind of slowly becomes aware of what's happened. Mm-hmm. They went to a house party, and they kind of have an argument over nothing, and he disappears. So nobody kind of realizes the fella's been missing for like a day or two, and so that's what the novel's about, yeah. I suppose it's a kidnapping, yeah.
It's definitely a kidnapping. We'll just decide on that. I really liked the compressed time period. I really, what you were saying about things being like forward momentum, I can really see that. How did you find writing something, like, is that your kind of favorite way to write? Would you ever go longer and write something that's set over like several years?
The first draft was looser.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
set over like a few weeks.
Yeah.
And it had like jumps where like you go back in time to see some shite that happened 2 years beforehand. The first draft was very different. So the whole, you know, when I say I wrote a second book or whatever, it was all just structural. It was to tighten it down. It was like, I just want to focus on, I'm going to start with the kidnapping. The first draft, the kidnapping also only happened halfway through the book.
Oh, I know.
It's a gold spatter caveat. Yeah. I like tell my editors it's about a kidnapping and they have to get to fucking page 150 before the kidnapping happens. Yeah.
And, I love to do this too.
It's so funny how it is. You're like, I'm nearly there. I'm nearly at the kidnapping.
Just a couple more chapters to go.
Just 18 months to go till I get to the kidnapping. When I was drafting it, I don't mind reading it. So, you know, basically it's like, the book's about a fucking kidnapping, so let's just start that. And it's not just about that, of course, but that's the engine of the plot, so let's structure it around that. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I picked my two main point of view characters, which is Dev, who's in the house that they bring the kid to, and Nikki, who's his girlfriend. And that's it. I was like, I'm cutting out everything that's not to do with them. And that was the way I did it. And it's, you know, it's hard to do. You cut out what you think is some fine writing. But again, it doesn't matter if it's good writing or not. It's just whether it fits or not. So I had to be kind of ruthless with that. So, but that was really, once I made that decision, I knew like, that's it.
Yeah,
I'm going to, I'll be able to get through this. It'll take however long it takes, but I can definitely get something done.
I really loved Nikki, that character. She's I feel very recognizable to me, but I feel... And you write women very well. Is that a challenge for you?
Thank you. I will just take the compliment. I mean, you know, it's...
Please, go ahead.
I hope so. I mean, I hope so. Yeah, there wasn't very many women in Young Skins, obviously, because it was just all from the point of view of, like, lads, but...
But I think that made sense for it to be...
It sounds whatever disingenuous to say. I never thought about it in either case. You're just like, well, these were just the stories I was writing that were sort of presenting themselves to my imagination. So you just did it. Yeah, I mean, I just hope it worked. I mean, it's funny who you in the novel. It's great talking about a novel no one can read for 4 months. But
and I love having read it.
But. Just listen to this podcast now. Then in 2024, buy my book. Then go back and re-listen after you've read it.
You'll learn a lot more.
You learned so much. And so the lad who's kidnapped is Dahl English, and he's a pretty central character in it. And his older brother and his mother is in it. In the first draft, I was doing chapters from their point of view. So you know, again, if you've read the book, they're key characters. And but I realized it wasn't going to work. If I went into their mind, like Dahl is a main character, but you never get a chapter from his point of view. You never see anything from his point of view, which is great fun to write. Once I realized that's what I should do. I love doing that. I love deciding what characters will be a point of view character and who won't be, and how you can still make them come as alive as you can. And in all the earlier drafts, I did one from his point of view. I was doing ones from his elder brother's point of view. I was doing one from his mother's point of view. So. Yeah, who the point of view is ends up being vitally important, which should be obvious before you start. But you need to get it right for the story to work, the structure to work, and so that was a very profound lesson I learned by immense trial and error writing
the
novel.
I also think by reading the novel, which I'm sure all the listeners will do in 2024, you can feel all the stuff that you got rid of. You know, you can feel the point of view of the mother, and I think it gives the book,
yeah,
like
you can look at it progressive and be like, well, I needed to do that to be able to write them, for them to end up the way they are, to feel or whatever. Like, that's probably what needed to happen. So, it's all, you know, it's all part of it, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was, you write violence very well. And these kind of sudden moments of, and almost moments of, you know, it feels like just a second of like... Or something bad might happen is almost worse in your stories than something bad actually happening on the page. How do you write that kind of tension?
I do what a bit of violence. Well, it's funny how to write it, because violence is as you said, like, it's the book probably isn't like Wild Houses, and indeed the two collections probably aren't. isn't that much violence
no,
in them.
There isn't.
There's a few really stark examples of it, but it is. It's especially Wild Houses. It is just like, I mean, Dahl is kidnapped and he is being held against his will. And the two lads who do it, the Ferdier brothers, are almost trying to, they themselves, even though they've done it and they are the architects of it, they are almost like trying to be like, well, you're now, you know, you're just here having a good time. Yeah. Have a beer, relax. And, you know, Dev understands the situation, but he also is just going along with it. And you know, so the violence is in the air. And it's funny because the person who's most likely to, be on the receiving end of violence is the one who, of necessity, has to be most acutely aware of it.
Yeah.
Everyone else, the perpetrators of it, can have the luxury of at any one moment pretending they mightn't do it. Mightn't do it. And so that sort of dynamic, that tension, how it can force people to do things without having to explicitly force them to do it. I mean, that's kind of what I said when I said Wild House. Is it kind of about a kid? The idea is they're constantly telling this fella, it's not as bad as you think.
Mm.
Just calm down, you know.
Just in a house.
You're in a house and listen, have a drink and watch The Wolf of Wall Street and be quiet. And, you know,
it's The Wolf of Wall Street.
But he is kidnapped and it is insane, you know, and Dev starts adoringly, just continues to realize this, he can't ignore it. So that sort of, that ugly, awful, like when violence is still latent, it's in the air. That's an awful feeling. That's the worst thing in the anticipation. It's an awful, if anyone's ever been in that position, it's an awful position to be in. So that is, you know, I was trying to write and capture that awful feeling.
Yeah, and I think
as opposed to wanting to write about violence for its own sake.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I think you do it brilliantly. So will you be working on a second novel? Or more stories?
End stories, I'm doing a story right now, and that's the second novel I've gone into. Yeah, we'll see.
Oh, great. Okay.
Should be out in 14 years. You know?
We'll wait. Do you think you'll ever publish that story about the priest? Or?
Oh, God. Oh, man.
Maybe
I don't think Ireland's ready for it still. Yeah,
too many harsh and uncomfortable truths.
Too many harsh and uncomfortable truths, yeah. If you do yours, we'll do an anthology of writers who wrote teenage stories about the Catholic Church.
I think it'd be brilliant. Colin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
Big thank you to Colin for joining us for the podcast today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it, or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. We'll be back next month with another reading a story from the Stinging Fly archive. Access to the Stinging Fly's full archive is available to anyone who subscribes to the magazine and to our patrons. Taking out a subscription is a great way to support what we do. Subscribe at stingingfly.org. I want to thank the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the best new writers and new writing. Thank you for listening.